The sun is yellow and low on the horizon against an orange sky. Trees grow from the calm waters of a marsh. The Pelican Brief. Sunlight is reflected off the gently rippling water as we move over the marsh. A single bird flies over the water. A strip of land that reaches out into the marsh is crowded with pelicans. Many fly off and join hundreds more flying overhead. The pelicans gently flap their long wings as they fly low over the water. They're silhouetted against the orange sky. The sun is higher now as we continue to move slowly over the marshland. A police officer in riot gear is in a crowd of demonstrators. Signs are held up in the crowd. Some of them read, "No justice, no peace. Abortion is murder. Save our cities. Save our children. Fur is death. Honor Mother Earth. Death to Rosenberg. Execution is no solution. AIDS cure now." Demonstrators are trying to push past police. They're in front of the Supreme Court building in Washington, D.C. Inside, two men are looking out a window. The older man is wearing a judge's robe and sitting in a wheelchair. The younger man is standing behind him.
Any of those signs got my name on them?
Quite a few.
What do they say?
The usual. Death to Rosenberg. Retire Rosenberg. Cut off the oxygen.
That's my favorite.
He has an oxygen tank nearby.
Of course, you, Mr. Grantham, did pretty good by me your last time out. Rosenberg equals the government over business, the individual over government, the environment over everything. And the Indians, give them whatever they want.
Well, with all due respect, sir, that wasn't my line. That was a quote.
From one of your unnamed senior White House officials, your senior White House son of a bitch, you should have said, got in there by stirring up these people one against the other.
He points out the window.
Never fails to amaze me what a man will do to get an Oval Office.
Small waves ripple in the ocean at night. A sailboat floats on the horizon. A man in an inflatable motorboat comes to shore on an empty beach. He gets out of the boat and puts a briefcase and a garment bag on the sand. He points a flashlight across the water and turns it on and off twice. He watches as two flashes of light signal back to him from the sailboat in the distance. He picks up his luggage and walks away. Later, in the woods, he takes a small pouch from the branch of a tree. He opens it and puts his garment bag into the bed of a pickup truck parked nearby. He gets into the truck with the briefcase and pulls out of a clearing onto a dirt road. Later, he's driving on a highway over a bridge. It's the Arlington Memorial Bridge, entering Washington, D.C. at the Lincoln Memorial. At the other end of the reflecting pool, the morning sun rises behind the Washington Monument. A man's watch reads 6 minutes past eight. He picks up a manila envelope and walks to his hotel room door.
Yes.
Looking for Mr. Sneller.
Mr. Sneller?
Yes. Mr. Edwin F. Sneller.
Sneller slides the envelope under the door. A man on the other side picks it up and goes into the room next door. He's carrying a briefcase and garment bag. He puts down his luggage and picks up the phone.
Hello?
Everything is in place.
He opens the envelope.
All the money must be there when I arrive in Zurich.
It will be there, if the job is finished.
He takes out a photo.
It will be finished.
The photo is of the Supreme Court justices. Two of them are circled. One of the two is Rosenberg.
May I help you?
Hello, I'd like to order some room service, please.
Yes, what would you like?
Coffee.
Mm-hmm.
Scrambled eggs, whole wheat toast, and orange juice, please.
All right, that'll be about 15 minutes.
Thank you very much.
When we substitute a threat for an argument, violence for principle, we allow our passion to overcome our capacity for reason. Passion and self-interest are threats to liberty. Which brings us to Bowers against Hardwick. A police officer entered Mr. Hardwick's apartment, ostensibly to serve him with a warrant for an unpaid violation for drinking in public. They caught him with an open bottle of beer. When he entered Mr. Hardwick's bedroom, he coincidentally found him in bed with another man. The officer arrested Hardwick for violating Georgia's statute which outlaws sodomy. Now, even though Georgia dropped the case, Hardwick brought suit to challenge the constitutionality of the statute. Now, what was his claim?
Students raised their hands.
Yeah.
That it violates his right of privacy.
Why?
Because it's Hardwick's home. He's got a right to do as he pleases there.
But what if he decided to sell drugs at his home or engage in child abuse in his home? Yeah.
Because those actions don't fit within the right of privacy. The court, beginning with Griswold, has limited the right of privacy to actions which are intimate, which are deeply personal, actions which allow us to control our lives, to define who we are.
Yeah, but how is that a constitutional claim? There's no right to define oneself written into the Constitution. There's not even a right of privacy in the Bill of Rights.
If the state of Georgia can regulate Hardwick's sexuality engaged in private with consenting adults, Hardwick cannot be free. The Constitution was written to ensure limited government. If there's no right of privacy, if Georgia can enforce the statute, we sacrificed the liberty the framers thought they guaranteed us.
Well, the Supreme Court disagreed with you, Miss Shaw. They found that the statute did not violate the right of privacy. Now, why is that?
Because they're wrong.
At night, two men get out of a car and take the places of two other men standing outside a building. One of them waves to a male nurse in the window. The nurse waves back and closes the drapes. Inside, Justice Rosenberg is asleep in a hospital bed.
How do you play
borderline sexual attraction.
Uh-huh, you mean he has just got it.
Oh, he's got it.
Has he ever?
Okay, what I think you're saying is that if you could clone three of him, you'd all be happy. Okay, tell us, what is your secret?
His nurse is watching television.
But what I can say is it's a big secret. A very big secret.
The nurse slumps forward and falls to the floor.
I'm sure she hopes she's not watching, too.
Hey, Mom, she's kidding, right?
No!
Ladies, have you changed your opinion about her?
No!
Oh, you still like him, then.
Rosenberg has a bullet hole in his head and blood all over his pillow. Outside, a man jumps over a fence and jogs into an alley. It's the man from the hotel, wearing a tank top and running shorts. He looks around and takes headphones out of his waist pack. He puts them on and jogs away. Later, a man wearing a fishing hat walks into a nearly empty movie theater and takes a seat. Three or four other men are sitting alone in the small theater. He takes off his hat and puts it in his lap as he stares at the screen. He's the other circled justice from the photo. Man sits beside him with a tub of popcorn. It's the man from the hotel, and now he has a mustache. He eats some popcorn, then moves the tub to the empty seat next to him. His pants are belted with a rope. He slowly unties it and slides it from around his waist. He tightly grabs each end of the rope, puts it around the judge's neck, and pulls. The assassin sits back in his seat. He pulls the rope back from the judge and puts it in the tub of popcorn. Later, a man is dusting a chandelier in an elegant hallway as two men walk by.
They found Rosenberg around 1 a.m. His nurse was also murdered. Jensen was found 2 hours later in some queer club. Voiles called me, wildly upset. This is hardly good for the reputation of the FBI. He and Gaminski are on the way.
Gaminski?
Yeah. CIA should be involved, at least for now. You'll want to address the nation in a couple of hours. We'll have to wait until 7 at least if we want an audience.
They enter the Oval Office.
The coat and tie may seem a bit rehearsed this time in the morning. How about a cardigan?
You want me to talk to the nation in a time of crisis wearing a sweater?
Mr. President, I've already called Justice and told them to put together a preliminary list of nominees. Restructuring the court will be your legacy.
Two men enter.
Mr. President?
Mr. Voiles, does the FBI have any suspects?
It's too soon. We'll have ballistics and autopsies late this afternoon.
I would like to have a report on your security and where it broke down.
You're assuming it broke down, Mr. President.
We have two dead judges, both of whom were being protected by the FBI. Bob, I'd like a straight answer. Are these killings in any way linked to the CIA or to any agency, group, whatever, of the United States government?
I'm shocked you would even think it.
Bob, just look into it. Okay.
Mr. President, I'd suggest we meet back here at 5 o'clock this afternoon.
5 o'clock, gentlemen. Thank you.
Boyles and Gaminski leave. The president sits at his desk.
It's rally around the leader time. Your approval ratings will go through the roof.
A fountain is in a courtyard.
And that's the weather in New Orleans. This is Tim Ballew on WPKB. We need to interrupt our program now for a special bulletin.
Ladies and gentlemen, in a special address live from the White House, the President of the United States.
My fellow Americans.
He's wearing a cardigan.
Our country has suffered a grievous loss. Last night, Supreme Court Justices Rosenberg and Jensen were assassinated.
Ms. Shaw is in bed with a law professor.
These assassinations may be an attempt to strike at the very fabric of our government. But I can assure each and every American that these dastardly acts will not go unpunished.
The assassin gets out of a cab at the airport.
Everything is being and will be done to bring the culprit or culprits to justice. For justice must and shall prevail.
He goes to transatlantic check-in.
I wish you could have known him when I used to clerk for him. Last time I saw him, there was nothing left but the mind. That's why they killed him. The mind was still a threat.
The professor is sitting with Miss Shaw.
Why kill him now when he had so little time left?
Well, maybe they couldn't take a chance he'd last till the election.
So why Jensen? He was nominated by this president. He and Rosenberg had almost nothing in common.
Almost.
That's what they should be looking for, you know. Decisions on which the two of them agreed.
Boy, if there was ever a moment for a drink. You know, one day at a time, right?
She smiles at him and nods. He looks at her, smiles, and pushes the hair away from her face. Then he leans forward and kisses her.
We're talking a conspiracy, then who are the conspirators? If we've let foreign terrorists in again, there's going to be hell to pay, politically.
The intelligence community can't be blamed for a weakness in the immigration rules.
Denton, who are your suspects?
Well, this has to be kept very quiet, Mr. President.
Of course, this is the Oval Office.
The president is with Boyles and Gaminsky.
We know of at least 11 members of the underground army that have been in the D.C. area for a week, and we suspect them in at least 100 bombings of abortion clinics, ACLU offices, porno houses, gay clubs all over the country.
The truth is, you don't have a prime suspect.
They all look up.
Correct?
Boyles and Gaminsky are walking out.
What's your call?
They walk past the same housekeeper who was dusting earlier.
Ray Grantham has been covering the Supreme Court for the Washington Herald. You actually interviewed Justice Rosenberg before he was shot on, as it turned out, the day he died.
Yes.
Did he say anything then that might shed some light on these dreadful events?
Yes, he spoke about things off the record at the time because they would have been inappropriate coming from a sitting justice. But I think it would be appropriate to quote him now. He said that the campaign waged by the president was so ruthless in its manipulation of the middle-class spheres of minorities, had been so exploitive and divisive that it created a climate of distrust, and even more of...
You know, that Grantham's a man after my own heart.
Miss Shaw kisses the professor.
Everyone wants to know when you are starting classes again.
That includes me.
You know what they say, drinking makes depression worse.
What do they recommend for anguish? Where have you been?
The library. I studied a printout of the Supreme Court docket. I even made a list of possible suspects. And then threw it in the garbage because they'd be obvious to everyone.
And then you look for areas that Jensen and Rosenberg might have in common?
Exactly. Jensen was generally consistent in his protection of the rights of criminal defendants.
Some notable exceptions.
He's written 3 majority opinions, strongly protective of the environment, and he was near perfect in his support of tax protesters.
Ah, so you think they might have been assassinated by some insatiable tax collector?
Well, as yet I rule no one out. Everyone is assuming that the motive is hatred or revenge.
Or an attempt to influence the social agenda of the court.
What if the issue involved old-fashioned material greed? A case that involves a great deal of money.
Later, she's at a counter.
Can I help you? Yes, I'd like to see this file, please.
She hands the woman a sheet of paper.
Why?
It's
public record, isn't it?
Semi-public.
Are you familiar with the Freedom of Information Act?
In a basement, the woman opens a file drawer.
This file has all the pleadings and correspondence. The rest is discovery, exhibits, and the trial.
When was the trial?
Last summer. Went on for 2 months.
Where's the appeal?
Not perfected yet. I think the deadline is August 1st.
She leaves.
Thank you.
Miss Shaw looks through the files labeled only with 6-digit numbers. She pulls one out and starts to read it. Later, she's slouched at a computer. As she reads the screen, she sits upright. Then nods. She shakes her head and continues reading intently. Later, she's sitting on her bed surrounded by books and papers as she stares off into the distance. She lies down and stays awake. Later, she's at the library typing into a portable computer. She works at the end of a long aisle of bookshelves, and her hairstyle and clothing change as days pass. Pages come off a printer. The top one reads in part, Darby Shaw, New Orleans, Louisiana, Tulane University. She places the pages in a folder and puts it aside.
So who done it, Miss Shaw? If some obscure suspect unknown to the FBI and the CIA and the Secret Service and 10,000 police departments?
I had one. Oh, which I have now discarded.
She sits heavily in a chair.
You mean you skipped class and ignored me for a week and now you're throwing it away?
She nods.
Let me see it.
She hands him the folder.
Don't laugh. It was ludicrous of me to think that I could solve it. Hubris of the young, huh?
Oh, don't knock the hubris that I love.
He looks through it, then walks across the room and sits.
I'm leaving tomorrow. I'm going to head up to Rosenberg's memorial in Washington. You know, I was going through Rosenberg's decisions the other night. And in the back of my mind was this idea maybe I'd do a book on him, you know.
No one could do it better.
You know, I started making notes about what he meant to me. Surrogate father, mentor, you know, the drill. And I started to get very thirsty.
She kneels in front of him.
I deserted you this week. Not the greatest timing.
You're here to study law, not keep me so.
He kisses her.
Darby, it's Alice.
Yeah?
I'm going out for a burger. You want to come?
No, thanks.
They stand together.
Might do you good to get out.
They kiss passionately.
I'm fine, thanks.
Sure?
Mm-hmm.
He presses her against the wall.
Okay. Bye-bye.
He starts to lift her shirt, and they continue kissing.
Hey, son.
Oh, hey, son.
Greg Grantham takes a note from the president's housekeeper.
Dark coffee, 3 sugars. Sounds the president.
Which one?
Not cold, the real one.
Cool and mellow. Would you believe he's all talk about Rosenberg? And all fired up about restructuring the court. Thinks it'll make his place in history.
Sounds like Cole. What'd you get me?
He looks at the note.
There's a short list of nominees. The original had 20 or so names. Then they cut it to 8. I gave you 2.
What about the investigation?
I haven't heard much. But as usual, I'll keep my ears open.
I know you will. Thank you.
I got that.
Thank you. I'll see you later.
Mellow, mellow, mellow.
A Washington Herald headline reads, White House Court Shortlist.
I'll have a martini, please.
Hey.
Good to see you.
The professor is at a bar.
Another coffee, please.
You've been reading that damn Grantham article. This thing's had me running around all day.
Cole called and blasted the director and said that the names of these judges was leaked by the FBI. So the director said that Cole had leaked them himself to test the water. So it's back and forth, back and forth.
Cole, that bastard. He ran the most divisive campaign in 20 years, and the president acted like it wasn't even happening.
You know, I would have liked to have seen your name on this list of judges. You were the one we all voted most likely to make the court.
Well, these days it's hard enough just to make my class.
Yeah? How old is she this time?
24, but she's extremely mature.
24, she's mature. I don't know if I believe that. Do you have a photo?
No, I don't have a photo. She's not a puppy dog or a grandchild.
Thank God.
Who killed him, Gavin?
Hey, Thomas, I'm just a lawyer with the Bureau. I'm not an agent.
Yeah, but as I recall, you have great ears, my friend.
Well, you know, to be perfectly honest, we don't have a clue.
Well, you know, my girlfriend, this girl, she wrote a very interesting essay on who might have ordered the assassinations. It's a little bit left field.
Your girlfriend has a theory?
Here, you ought to take a look at it.
He hands Gavin an envelope.
You get a kick out of the way her mind works.
Sure.
Gray Grantham is jogging down the sidewalk, and he stops in front of a house. He unlocks the door and goes to the phone.
Hello. Is this Greg Grantham with the Washington Herald?
Yes, it is.
I'm sorry to call you at such a crazy hour. I'm on my way to work, and I stopped at a payphone. I can't call from home or the office.
He checks his watch.
What kind of office?
I'm an attorney.
Private or government?
I'd rather not say. I may know something about Rosenberg and Jensen.
He picks up a notepad.
Are you recording this?
No.
This call be traced?
No, I'm not recording it, and I'm not tracing it, I promise you.
I think I may know who killed him.
Gray starts to write.
What's your name?
Garcia.
It's not your real name, is it?
No. I think I stumbled across something at the office that I wasn't supposed to see.
Do you have a copy of it?
About this. I haven't slept in a week. I
understand.
I'm not thinking rationally.
Okay. Listen, I promise you I will protect you as a confidential source. Hello. Hello.
He leans forward and looks at the display on the phone.
Gotcha.
At the newspaper, a man answers the phone at Gray's desk.
Yeah. Mr. Grantham's not here, but he left his car number for you.
From a phone booth.
Grantham?
Yes.
Garcia. I still don't know what to do.
Mr. Garcia, I want you to understand that I've gone to jail rather than reveal a source. I know what kind of hell this must be for you.
Grantham has a camera and is watching him.
You're clearly a decent human being, a good citizen. But do you really think you could live with yourself in peace if you don't reveal what you know?
He takes pictures with a telephoto lens.
I'll get back to you.
Garcia comes out of the phone booth and walks away. Grantham gets out of his car, pulls up the hood on his jacket, and runs after him. When he catches sight of him, he walks, staying some distance behind. Garcia hails a cab and drives off.
Taxi! Taxi!
A cab stops, but then drives off. He kicks it as it pulls away. Two men are in Fletcher Cole's office.
The French authorities were routinely reviewing footage taken by the security cameras at the Paris airport, and they thought they recognized a face that might be Kamel's, the terrorist. He may have been on a flight that arrived from Dulles about 10 hours after we found Jensen's body.
Anything else?
Well, maybe a small new wrinkle.
So what's the wrinkle?
It's a theory that surfaced in the last 24 hours, and Director Voiles is very intrigued by it. He's afraid that it might be damaging to the president.
He gives Cole a binder with the FBI seal on the cover.
How's that?
It's all there in brief.
Cole opens it and reads Darby's name and address. Later, the same two FBI men are with Voiles.
It's amateur stuff. But how often does something come along that makes Cole sweat and run for cover?
Well, he didn't exactly sweat in front of us. But when he gets that great stone face, you know he's not exactly happy.
Was the president suffering from any symptoms?
As I told you people before, the president is just here for his annual checkup. I wish I was in as good shape as he is.
Has this been Tom DeKennedy's age issue in this next election?
Well, George, why didn't I think of that? The president has not even decided whether he's going to run again.
When did he plan to make that decision?
Well, you don't actually expect me to answer that, do you? One rumor I can unequivocally deny is that the president has checked into the hospital to get away from all of you people. Although I don't think you blame him, would you?
The president poses for a photo.
Okay. Thank you again, Lieutenant.
Thank you, Mr. President.
And, Commander, you go downstairs and tell them I have a date for golf this afternoon.
Yes, sir.
She leaves. Cole is in the room.
It's killing the press that you're in such good shape.
Good. Now, what's so important?
This is a brief.
He hands it to him.
Written by an eager beaver Tulane law student. It's a theory on who's behind the assassinations. And indirectly, it implicates the White House. Now, the premise behind this thing is so far-fetched it's absurd. But Director Voiles, for reasons that you and I both can guess, is going after it.
Well, we can't interfere with his investigation.
I think you should ask Kaminsky to have CIA investigate. The second we confirm that this thing is garbage, you can ask Voiles to back off.
It's domestic. Well, CIA can't go nosing around. It's illegal.
Mm-hmm. Technically.
What about your friend Barr in the unit, I think you call it?
I've spoken to Barr. They're very good for small specific missions, but they are not the CIA.
Well, how does it implicate the White House? What are the names?
One name.
Someone we both know.
Cole stares at him. The president looks at the brief and stands. He runs his hand around the binder, then drops it on the hospital bed. He walks to the window and opens the blinds. He opens the window and smiles at the reporters below. He waves and gives them the peace sign.
I've decided my agenda for the future. I'm going to stay in bed, drink, make love, and forget the whole damn business.
Darby and Thomas are in a restaurant.
You don't approve.
What about the book on Rosenberg?
You should write it.
She stands.
Come on, let's go.
No, I'm serious. You should. You have the youth, the energy, the certitude. You'd be perfect. You should write it.
Can I have the keys? Let's go.
He stands and his chair falls over. He holds the keys out of her reach.
I'm perfectly capable of driving.
You've had too much to drink, Thomas.
He walks her out of the restaurant in a dance embrace. He spins her around.
Very
good. Do you remember the mashed potato?
No.
You too young.
No, I know the mashed potato.
Do you remember the pizza?
Please.
The slide?
No, please.
Please what?
Please give me the keys. Okay, give me the keys. I'm going to drive or I'm going to walk.
You're going to walk?
Yes.
Well, have a nice stroll.
He walks away and she goes in the opposite direction.
Miss Shaw!
She turns and looks at him.
You take my breath away.
She smiles. Thomas's car explodes.
Thomas.
She runs toward the car.
Oh, my God! Oh, my God!
Darby is knocked to the ground by the force of a second explosion in the car. Later, she's in another car, resting her head against the window when a man knocks.
Watch the door, miss.
He opens the car door.
I'm Sergeant Rupert, NOPD.
He shows his badge.
You'll be safe in my car.
She brings a trembling hand to her lips, and another man looks in at her.
Could I have your name?
She wrinkles her forehead and fidgets with her ear.
Darby Shaw.
Rupert looks toward the siren, and he and the other man back away.
Let's go.
Darby watches as EMTs carry a stretcher with a body bag on it.
Is this your car?
A uniformed officer looks at her.
Come here.
She motions to a man.
Lieutenant Olson, New Orleans PD. I'm going to take you to the hospital.
He turns to the officer.
Check your place.
All right.
Did you know the man in the car?
Thomas Callahan.
Later, she's in the waiting area of a hospital.
There's no conscience.
Lieutenant Olson approaches.
It'll be a few minutes. Are you sure that the man who called himself Rupert said he was a cop? We don't have a record of a cop named Rupert. The computer, it has no record of the tag numbers of the car you were in. It must be fake tags. I'm going to move the car, and I'll be back. All right?
He leaves, and she stays seated. Her eyes are lowered as she looks back and forth. Her breath quickens. She slowly gets up and walks unsteadily out of the hospital, looking behind her as she goes. Outside, she walks across an empty street. Ahead of her is a large crowd of people drinking and dancing in the street. With her hands to her head, she tries to make her way through the crowd. A man dressed as a harlequin blows out a flaming torch and startles her. She closes her eyes for a moment, shakes her head, and continues through the crowd. Crowd fills the entire street and confetti rains down on them. People are crowded onto balconies above. Later, Darby signs her name to an American Express receipt. She walks into a dark hotel room and locks the door. She sits on the edge of the bed and closes her purse. Her bare knee shows through her long dress, and she trembles as she buttons it and pulls it tightly over her knees. Regis and Kathy Lee Show is on a small television in a bathroom.
Well, maybe you don't recognize the name, but I'm sure you recognize...
Thomas's friend Gavin is in a bathrobe.
Hundreds of thousands of magazines as part of the latest...
Hello?
...ad campaign.
Gavin Verheek?
Yeah.
They refer to
this
her
is Darby Shaw. Do you know who I am?
Yes, yeah. We have a mutual friend.
Thomas gave you a copy of my theory, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
Where is it now?
Oh, well, I read it, and I showed it to some folks at the Bureau, and then they sent it on to Director Voiles.
Has it been seen outside the FBI?
Well, I can't answer that, Darby.
Well, then I won't tell you what's happened to Thomas.
Oh, okay, yes. It's been seen outside the FBI, but by whom and by how many, I don't know.
He's dead, Gavin. He was murdered last night. Someone planted a car bomb for both of us. I got lucky, but now they're after me.
What's your phone number? Where are you staying?
Not so fast, Gavin.
Come on, Darby. Thomas Callahan was my best friend. Give me 15 minutes and I'll have a dozen agents pick you up. You can't stay on the street.
Thomas is dead because he talked to you. You tell that to Director Voiles.
Turn up the TV. I can't hear Regis and Kathy Lee.
The president is playing with his dog.
That's... Look, down. Now, here. Down.
Director Voiles walks in.
Down.
Mr. President?
Down. Down. Sit down. You have to see this. We've been working on this all morning long. You have your first audience. Over. Roll over. Roll over. How seriously are you taking this Pelican thing?
I've assigned 14 agents in New Orleans. I doubt if there's anything to it, Mr. President, but we've got to check it out.
Well, Denton, I don't have to tell you how much trouble and pain this nonsense could cause if the press gets wind of it. Oh, well, you got half of it. Good boy.
He gives the dog a treat.
I just wish that you'd back off of the thing. I mean, what the hell? It's a goose chase.
Are you asking me to ignore a suspect, Mr. President?
If the press gets wind of what you're after and starts digging, we'll be crucified.
Voiles leans back in his seat.
So you're asking me to back off?
The president sits next to him.
Back off and chase the real suspects. You know, ignore it for a couple of weeks. That's all.
Your hatchet man Cole has done a real number on me with the press. They have eaten my lunch over the security we provided for Jensen and Rosenberg. You get that pit bull off my ass, and I'll forget the Pelican theory for a while.
The president smiles and pats his dog while Cole watches them on a monitor in another room and grins. Darby is wearing a wig and walking through a hotel hallway. She's on the 20th floor, and she presses the down button on an elevator. She steps onto it. Several men are already inside. A balding man in the back of the elevator stares at her. And she looks back at him. The elevator stops at the 8th floor and a man gets on. Just as the doors start to close, Darby runs out. The balding man tries to push through the crowded elevator. Darby runs to a stairwell and heads down. The balding man is still on the elevator. Darby runs to the bottom of the stairs and goes through a door. The balding man comes running toward her. She runs through a kitchen and bumps into a waiter. She moves a bus cart to block the balding man, but he knocks it over. She runs onto a freight elevator and pushes the button. The elevator doors close as the man tries to reach between them. Later, she gets in line with a group of people getting off a bus. At a hotel counter, she takes out a credit card and looks around the busy lobby.
And may I have your card?
I'm going to pay with cash.
She takes out some 20s. Later, she's in her room on the phone.
Verheek?
Yes?
What did Mr. Voyle say?
Well, Mr. Voyle has been unavailable, Darby. And I will try to speak to him later this afternoon.
I expected more.
There's a memorial service tomorrow, with the burial afterward in the city. I'll be there tonight. I think that we should meet. Darby, I could save your life.
You can't even talk to the director. Where will you stay?
I'll be staying at the Westin by the river.
Okay.
She brings her hand to her forehead, then pulls off her wig. From a dark room in another wing of the hotel, someone is looking in the windows of other rooms. Four men are in the room, and they see Darby sitting on her bed.
She's watching television.
They've been looking under rocks. She's using credit cards. She'll be dead in 48 hours.
I'll give her 72. We'll meet at 6 a.m.
All right, Bob.
Two men leave.
Putin, stay.
Gominski walks to the window.
This means her little brief is right on point.
Are you going to notify the president?
Notifying the president means notifying Cole.
In Darby's room.
An article by Greg Grantham in tomorrow morning's edition of the Washington Herald maintains that, according to unnamed White House sources, the Middle Eastern terrorist known as Kamel may be one of those who carried out the assassinations of Justices Rosenberg and Jensen. Those same sources suggest that a country well known for sponsoring terrorist activity may have hired Kamel.
Gray is at home.
Yes.
Hello?
Garcia.
Yes.
I'm on the corner of Pennsylvania Avenue and First.
Okay. Listen, why don't you take down my license plate number because there's a lot of gray Volvos out there, okay?
Okay.
856 VNN.
He takes a tape recorder.
856 VNN.
Right.
Right, okay.
10 minutes.
Yeah.
Bye.
Shortly after, he starts out the door, but comes back in to get his keys.
Keys. Yes?
I can't go through with it.
Well, look, why don't we get together anyway? I think you'd feel better if we meet, and you don't have to reveal anything that you don't want.
I have a wife and a little daughter. There's a chance that they know that I know. They've been treating me funny.
The guys at the firm?
Yeah. No, wait. How did you know I was in a firm? I didn't tell you that.
Well, you go to work too early in the morning to be a government lawyer. You have to work at one of those firms where they expect junior partners and associates to put in at least $100 a week.
He grimaces. He throws his jacket on the floor.
Listen, Garcia, I know we can work this thing out if you just get together with me.
Garcia?
Who's this?
Is this Greg Grantham with the Washington Herald?
Yes, it is. Who's this?
Have you heard of the Pelican Brief?
The what?
Pelican Brief.
No. No, never heard of it.
It's an unlikely little theory about who killed Rosenberg and Jensen. It was taken to Washington last week by a friend of mine. He gave it to a friend with the FBI, and it was passed around. My friend was killed in a car bomb Wednesday night.
Wait. No. Your friend took it to another friend at the FBI? And then your friend was killed? What's his name, your friend?
I can't tell you that.
He starts to take notes.
Well, how is it that you know all of this?
wrote the brief.
Are you a lawyer?
No.
Where are you calling from?
I'd rather you not ask me any more questions.
You called me, I'm sorry, what's your name?
Alice.
You called me, Alice. I'm just trying to...
Can you get a list of all the major contributors to the president's last campaign?
Yes. Sure, I can have it tomorrow. And you know who's done these killings? Well, let's cut to the chase, Alice. Who did it?
Let's take it slow. I'll be in touch.
When?
His notes read, Pelican brief, not a lawyer, law student, name not Alice. Later, Darby's friend Alice walks through a crowded bar. A man in a blue shirt is following her at a distance. Darby is sitting on top of a washing machine in a laundry room. Her hair is tucked under a baseball cap that's pulled down low over her forehead. Alice joins her. The man in the blue shirt looks at them, then steps away.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
How are you, huh?
Did you get into my apartment okay?
Your computer's gone. So are your floppy disks. So are your red expandable files.
I need you to do me a favor. Go to the memorial service tomorrow. Spread the word that I called from Denver. I'm staying with an aunt whose name you don't know, and I won't be back till the fall.
What is going on? Are you okay about money?
Yeah, I have the money my father left.
Who are you hiding from?
I think you better go now, Alice.
Alice stares at her.
It would be better for me if you go now.
Alice hesitates, then tugs gently on the bill of Darby's cap as she leaves. The man in the blue shirt is at a pinball machine.
Boy, that's not fair. Prettiest girl in the quarter, the saddest girl in the quarter. I can't get you to give me one little smile.
Darby looks at him and smiles weakly.
I saw that. That's something.
He walks away. Darby walks through the bar, and he grabs her wrist.
Just one beer?
No, thanks.
She starts to walk away.
I've found my mission in life. To make you smile.
I'm afraid you're going to have to find another mission.
She pulls her wrist from him and walks outside. He checks his watch, glances around, then follows.
Oh, wait.
So, will you marry me? Just for 5 minutes. I know it's stupid, but I think we're fated for each other.
No, I really have to go now.
You're not going to walk out on me like this, are you?
I'd walk a million miles for one of your smiles. Oh, you're beautiful, you wonderful girl from the laundry.
That's wrong, girl.
She pulls away. The balding man comes through the crowd, and the man in the blue shirt points in Darby's direction. She sees the balding man coming toward her, and she turns and runs through the crowd. He starts to gain on her, and Darby bumps into a large tattooed man. He pulls her behind him. The balding man punches the tattooed man in the stomach and throws him to the ground. Another man grabs the balding man, but he knees him in the groin and he falls. Two more men grab the balding man and they fight.
the man who claimed to be Sergeant Rupert watches the fight from a doorway. Darby enters her hotel room and locks the door. She sits in a chair in the dark with her knees pulled in tight to her chest. In another hotel room, a manila envelope is on a bed.
Yes.
Looking for Mr. Sneller.
Mr. Sneller?
Yes, Mr. Edwin F. Sneller.
Sneller picks up the envelope and slips it under the door. The assassin picks it up and goes into the next room. He lies on the bed and opens the envelope. He takes out a small picture of Darby. The next day, Darby is watching from a distance as people enter a church for the memorial service. Gavin Verheek stands by the door and overhears Alice talking with other students.
Yeah, I did. I got a note from her, and she's staying with an aunt in Colorado, but she's going to be back next semester, so,
Rupert is walking around the church grounds. The balding man is there, too, and he sees Gavin.
I'll see you later.
Gavin checks his watch and enters the church. Darby looks on from a second-story window in a nearby building. Gavin is in his hotel room wearing a bathrobe.
Hello?
Gavin, it's Darby.
Ah, I just about given up on you. Tell me where you want to meet, and within an hour I'll come get you with three agents.
Thought the FBI was not involved.
It's not involved, not yet. I have friends. And when we get you out of the city tonight, we can have you in Washington by tomorrow. And I promise you'll personally meet Voiles. And we'll go from there.
At noon tomorrow, take the trolley to a place called Riverwalk.
Wait, Riverwalk?
Yes. Wear a long-sleeved shirt and a red baseball cap.
He writes on a notepad.
Wait on the riverside of the bandstand, and I'll find you.
The riverside bandstand?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. How tall are you?
5'10".
How much do you weigh?
About 180, but I'm planning on losing it.
I'll see you tomorrow, Gavin.
Tomorrow.
A recording device is attached to the underside of the nightstand under the phone. With a towel around his waist, Gavin walks out of the bathroom and looks at his notes. He picks up a remote control and turns on the television.
Oh, jeez. They're back. What the hell do they want?
Good morning.
The mirrored sliding door of a closet slowly opens a few inches. Gavin walks past it into the bathroom and squeezes toothpaste onto his toothbrush. As he brushes his teeth, he walks out of the bathroom. He looks at his reflection in the closet door, grabs his belly, then sucks it in. He turns from the mirror, picks up his notepad, and grabs a chocolate from the bed.
Now don't poke fun at me, but I answered a few personal ads. 40 or 50 to be.
He starts to unwrap it,
I know.
Then throws it down and sits on the bed in front of the television. He looks at the notepad and tries to sit up straight. The closet door opens slowly.
Experimented with some hairstyles.
Blood splatters on the television.
Right out of the blue.
The assassin lays the gun on the bed. He removes the recording device from under the phone and listens to it while he eats the partially unwrapped chocolate.
Hello?
Gavin, it's Darby.
I just start giving up on you. Tell me where you want to meet, and within an hour I'll come get you with three agents.
I thought you said the FBI was not involved.
The FBI is not involved yet. But I have friends. We can get you out of the city tonight. We can have you in Washington by tomorrow. I promise you'll personally meet Boyle. And we can go from there.
At noon tomorrow, take the trolley to a place called Riverwalk.
Riverwalk?
Wear a long sleeve shirt and a red baseball cap. Wait on the riverside of the bandstand and I'll find you.
The riverside bandstand?
Yes.
Okay.
How tall are you?
5'10".
How much do you weigh?
I weigh about 180, but I'm planning on losing. All right.
The next day, the assassin pads his stomach and looks in a mirror.
Tell me where you want to meet. Tell me where you want to meet, and within an hour, I'll come and get you with three agents.
He's wearing a long-sleeve shirt and a red baseball cap. Later, a trolley pulls up. The assassin steps off and walks toward the festive Riverside Marketplace. Darby is waiting under the arch of a building nearby. She watches as the assassin walks through the crowd. Stops next to the bandstand. Darby swallows, then slowly makes her way to him. They talk for a moment, and she motions toward the riverboat, then takes his hand. Rupert is watching as they walk toward the boat. At a cash register, they buy two tickets, then stand in a line for the riverboat. As the line progresses, the assassin slowly takes his gun out of his pocket. He looks at her and smiles. He hides the gun under his shirt and points it at her. Blood splatters on Darby's face and the assassin falls to the ground.
Darby lets go of his hand and runs away. The crowd quickly disperses, leaving the assassin's body lying on the pavement in a puddle of blood. Later, a man with a gold watch is sitting at a desk.
Mr. Sneller on line two, sir.
Yes.
Camilla's dead. We don't know who did it.
And the girl?
She's running. We lost her. We'll find her.
He gets up and looks out his office window to a security desk in the lobby below. At the newspaper, Gray is on the phone.
There's been another murder. You remember I told you my friend gave a copy of the brief to a friend at the FBI?
Yes.
A friend from the FBI was killed yesterday.
How'd you know?
I was holding his hand when he was shot, in broad daylight, in the middle of a crowd.
I'm very sorry.
I'm in New York now. When can you come here?
Well, I'm afraid you're going to have to give me something I can confirm. You see, we get so many crank calls from people claiming to have tips on who killed Rosenberg and Jensen.
You need something you can confirm.
Please.
Such as?
The name of your friend that was murdered in the car explosion. Take your time.
Callahan.
He writes it down.
His first name is?
Thomas.
Where did this explosion take place?
In New Orleans. I think that should be enough.
All right. Oh. What's the name of the friend that worked at the FBI that was murdered?
Verheek. Gavin Verheek.
Boyle's chief counsel.
I think that's more than enough.
I'll be on the plane this afternoon.
You have to follow my instructions.
Gray runs to a payphone in a park.
Hello? This is Greg Grantham. That's right. Got it.
He walks away. Darby opens her hotel room door, but leaves the chain on and looks through.
Did you follow my instructions?
Yes.
She closes the door, unhooks the chain, and lets him in. He watches as she walks to the window.
Must think I'm crazy.
Yes, I did. Till I checked New Orleans, Callahan was killed exactly as you said. And I also checked on Verheek. According to the FBI, they found his body the day before yesterday in a hotel room very early in the morning. They said he'd been dead for at least 8 hours.
Can't be.
You want to talk about the brief?
Everyone I've told about the brief is dead.
I'll take my chances.
You can't, under any circumstances, use my name or reveal where or how you got the information or publish anything until I've left the country, agreed?
Unless I can convince you otherwise.
Well, you can't.
Sit down.
She nods.
You mind if I use a tape recorder?
He turns on the tape recorder.
Fletcher Cole is in a limousine showing a copy of the Pelican brief to another man.
Interesting read, isn't it, Barr?
What did the president say?
He spoke to Boyles about it. And Boyles agreed to leave it alone for a while.
The president asked Boyles to back off?
We thought it was just another shot in the dark. Now I'm not so sure.
That's obstruction of justice.
Assuming the brief turns out to be true?
If it does, you'll be the fall guy.
Cole looks out the window.
I won't be the only one.
The old Nixon two-step.
Don't even think that name.
Oh, look on the hopeful side. Irangate, Irakgate. Good chance it won't even come out.
What's up with Grantham?
We got his car phone. We haven't been inside the apartment yet.
Why not?
We almost got caught by the cleaning lady.
Cole turns to Barr.
Grantham knows about the brief, Barr. He called 3 White House aides this morning. And God knows who else.
With Darby.
What made you hone in on this particular case so quickly?
I remembered this piece that Frontline did about a year ago. About the young lawyer who originally filed the suit. They said he'd committed suicide, but his family felt it was foul play. After the assassinations, I called his family. They said he had a depressive problem years before, but it had been taken care of with medication. His doctor confirmed what the family said, and they told the police they were not convinced it was suicide.
But the police closed the investigation.
Well, that's it. That's the brief. Maybe we could finish up in the morning.
Gray gets up and turns off the tape recorder.
I'm going to be up most of the night going over my notes while they're still fresh in my head. Call me when you wake up.
Okay.
Try and get some sleep.
He starts to leave.
Mr. Grantham. I know it sounds silly, but would you mind sleeping on the sofa?
She gets up and heads for the bedroom.
Good night. Listen, at the risk of sounding old-fashioned, don't you think it's time I knew your real name?
Darby Shaw.
What made you pick me, Darby Shaw?
Kellyanne was a fan.
She shuts the door. Later, Gray is listening to the tape.
Does the name Victor Matisse mean anything to you?
Money? Power? Influence?
He's made and lost several fortunes drilling for oil in South Louisiana. In 1979, his oil company punched some holes in Terrebonne Parish and hit oil. A lot of oil. He knew he'd need government permission to dredge a channel through the marshlands to get the equipment in and the oil out. Enter Matisse, the great campaign contributor.
A clipping shows him with the president.
And as night must follow day, government permission to gouge through the endangered marshes.
Cole is looking at the brief.
Matisse is that close to at least $1 billion when Green Fund, an obscure environmental outfit, trots on down to the U.S. District Court in Lafayette and files a lawsuit to stop the entire operation. course, Matisse spares no expense to win the lawsuit. I don't think there's a top law firm between Houston and New Orleans that at some point he hasn't hired.
PBS.
Cole has a video.
By the time the Green Fund lawyers, all two of them, weighed in, the joint ventures, limited partnerships, and corporate associations form an impenetrable maze that make Matisse invisible. Luckily for the Green Fund's lawsuit, the heart of the new oil reserve is near a natural refuge for waterfowl. Osprey, egrets, pelicans, ducks, cranes, geese. The pelican becomes the hero. After 30 years of contamination by DDT and other pesticides, the Louisiana brown pelican perches on the brink of extinction. Green Fund seizes the majestic bird and enlists experts from around the country to testify on its behalf. Now it takes 7 years for the pelican suit to go to trial in Lake Charles. The three-man jury, caring less about the pelican than jobs, votes in favor of Matisse.
Cole watches the frontline video.
But the judge rules to keep the injunction against drilling in place because he thinks Green Fund has proven its point about the pelican, a federally protected species, and it's apparent that Green Fund will appeal.
So what's the status of the lawsuit?
From the trial level, it will be appealed to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans in about a month.
Any idea what the Fifth Circuit might do?
It could be reversed. Well, then the fun starts. If either side is unhappy with the Fifth Circuit, they can appeal to the Supreme Court.
So from today, how long would it take for the case to be decided by the Supreme Court?
Anywhere from 3 to 5 years.
Rosenberg would have died by natural causes.
Well, yes, but another president could be in the White House when he died. So if you're Victor Matisse and you don't mind killing a couple of Supremes, now's the time to take them out when you can predict their replacement.
But why Jensen?
He shared one piece of common ground with Rosenberg, protecting the environment.
Gray turns off the tape recorder. At the bottom of a page, he writes the name Garcia with an arrow that points to the words law firm. From there, he draws an arrow that points up to the name Matisse. Above that, he makes another up arrow pointing to the words White House. In the morning, Darby comes out of the room. Gray is asleep in a chair with the phone in his lap. He opens his eyes.
Didn't mean to wake you.
He sits up and puts the phone down.
You said that Matisse hired law firms from Houston to New Orleans. Were there any in Washington, D.C.?
I can think of two. White and Blazevich. And Brim Stearns and somebody.
Great. I got a call from a lawyer in D.C. He told me he saw something concerning Rosenberg and Jensen. Now, we were supposed to meet, but he backed out. I never heard from him again. He gave me a phony name, but I got his picture.
How'd you get his picture?
Well, that's another story, but if he works for one of these law firms, he could be our confirmation.
I hope you find him.
Darby, I need you to go with me to Washington.
No, I've had enough.
If you're right about Matisse, then it's going to be a cover-up. And the odds are it's going to work.
How can you be so sure?
I called into the Herald morgue last night. 2 years ago, a reporter did a piece on violations of campaign financing laws. In his research, he found out that hidden under a lot of other names of individuals and PACs and corporations, Matisse was the biggest contributor so far, by far, to the president's campaign. We ran a picture with the article of the president and Matisse. The picture was taken unbeknownst to either one of them. In it, the president and Matisse are standing in front of Matisse's hunting lodge, sipping on some bourbon, having a good laugh, the best of pals. The caption said, "President's most secret and generous contributor." Now, if your brief is right, and it ever reaches the light of day, The president has lost any chance for re-election. There are men around the president that won't let that happen. I checked with all my sources last night at the Bureau, Langley, the White House. All of them said the brief doesn't exist, never has. You may be the only witness that can ever prove there was a brief. If you disappear, so does justice. Is that what Callahan would want?
Thomas would want me to see my 25th birthday.
Darby, if this thing reaches as deep and goes as high as we think it does, these men will do anything not to be exposed. Where can you hide?
Go back to Washington.
She goes back into the bedroom.
They all shook up about you asking about something or another. I didn't get it all.
I expected that.
It's like Gestapo over there. Cold clears everything. They put me on medical leave for 90 days.
What's wrong with you?
Damned if I know. One thing I do know, I've never seen it this bad. I worry about you, son.
Sarge walks away from Gray in a subway station. Later, Gray is at home.
Gray, it's Darby. By the time you hear this, I'll be in the air on my way to nowhere. Try to understand.
At the newspaper.
I can't afford to keep you on that story. I'm sending you to Arkansas. The Times, the Journal, the networks already have their guys down there checking out that judge they're about to nominate to the court.
I need more time.
For what? You've lost your sources at the White House. You've had no luck with Garcia. You've lost the girl. On balance, not your best week.
You can't take me off this story.
His boss sits back in his chair.
What do you know for a fact? Some guy who won't identify himself says he knows something about the assassinations. You think he works for a law firm, but you don't know which one. Now he's cut off all contact with you. That's not promising as these things go.
You can't take me off this story. There's something there. I can smell it.
Evidence based on olfactory prowess is inadmissible, in case you didn't know. And then there's this girl with her bird brief, for which you still can get no confirmation, correct?
Not yet.
Yeah, she also has cut off contact. Cutting off contact with you is reaching epidemic proportions.
They're still waiting for you upstairs.
Right. Everything the girl has said about the death of Callahan and the death of Verheek has been confirmed, right?
The FBI says Verheek was killed in some hotel mugging. Isn't that what you told me?
That's what they told me.
Didn't they also say that they knew of no connection with the assassinations?
Yes, well, what else are they going to say?
I'm only interested in what they did say.
They walk out of his office.
Let's look back at what I have confirmed. Callahan was killed in a car explosion. He was a law professor at Tulane. They had an affair.
Yeah, give it to the Times Picayune. Maybe they want some local post-mortem gossip.
I also found out the Callahan clerk for Rosenberg 20 years ago.
And they both were killed. Life is full of odd coincidences.
Not a coincidence when you factor in a brief.
Supposition. You have no confirmation there ever was a brief.
But I did confirm that Verheek and Callahan were old friends. According to Verheek's secretary, they met right here in Washington a few weeks ago, which is when he must have given him the brief.
Supposition again.
I got total confirmation on the Pelican lawsuit.
On which she has based her suppositions.
So much of suppositions.
Do you know what Matisse could do to us?
I know what Matisse has done already. He has a pretty bizarre history.
So do I, according to my ex-wife. It doesn't mean I assassinated Rosenberg and Jensen.
But it does mean it's worth exploring.
Okay, why don't you go down to that crappy cabin of yours on the weekend? Hole up, retrench. If you can prove to me that you've got a way to bring this story back to life, I might keep you on it.
Gray's boss gets on an elevator.
But if I were you, I'd be checking where to eat in Little Rock.
Later, Gray is in his cabin watching the frontline video.
This is the story of a mystery that may never be solved. The story of a brilliant young lawyer who loved this beautiful land and was prepared to fight to preserve it from the inroads of man. Until his abrupt death, he went through. His body was found in a lonely cottage near the Louisiana bayou he so loved, with a bullet in his head and a gun beside him. The coroner and police have deemed it a suicide, but he died sitting at a computer surrounded by all his notes for what he called the case he was born to win. His friends and family asked, would anyone commit suicide in such a manner and at such a time? Tonight, Frontline explores the death of a young idealist. Suicide or murder?
Gray turns off the television and walks toward the door. He looks out a window and sees someone in the dark with a flashlight. He picks up a rifle and opens the door. Outside, he stands on the porch and looks through the rain into the woods. He sees the beam of the flashlight in the trees.
Who's out there?
It's Darby!
Later, she's sitting on the hearth of the fireplace, and he hands her a mug. He sits on a coffee table in front of her.
I got your message.
If they bugged the phone in your apartment, I wanted them to think I left the country. Did you find that young lawyer in D.C.?
Not yet. My editor wants to take me off the story.
Maybe I could help you find him.
How'd you find me?
Called the paper and asked for your editor.
And he told you?
I told him I was your sister Mary, in from out of town, and couldn't find you.
How'd you know I had a sister Mary?
You're not the only one that does research.
They both smile. Armed men in blue uniforms look through binoculars from the balconies of a cathedral. The president walks out and reporters are waiting at the entrance.
It's good to see you, Mr. President.
Reverend, it was a beautiful service. Very moving.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Bill. I'll have an announcement after the weekend.
He gets into a limousine, and Cole is sitting inside.
Well, it was the right thing to do, no matter where the body was found.
Officers on motorcycles lead the motorcade away from the cathedral.
You're not going to have those nominations to announce next week.
You said they'd all be vetted by the weekend.
I know, but there has to be a change in plans.
I don't understand.
The Pelican Brief.
The president looks at him.
What about the Pelican Brief? I thought that was ancient history.
We have reason to believe that Greg Grantham's gotten a hold of it.
Matisse will sue the pants off them. They try to publish that?
Not if it's true.
A smile fades from the president's face.
You think it's true?
I know what Grantham's gonna write. A man the president knew and took millions from, paid money to have two Supreme Court justices knocked off so that his pal the president could appoint more reasonable men to the bench, so that his oil could be harvested. And if our friend Voiles leaks that you asked him to hold off investigating the brief, we could be into an obstruction charge. Mr. President, there is a way to handle this.
Handle it how?
We appoint two nature lovers to the court. Good little environmentalists would kill Matisse and his oil field, etc. And you call Voiles into your office, and in the presence of the Attorney General, you demand an immediate investigation into Matisse. Ali copies the brief to every reporter in town, and then we hunker down and ride out the storm.
But there has to be some way to keep this information from coming out.
I'm working on it.
What? How?
Mr. President, you don't want to know.
People in 18th century costumes are playing music on a lawn. Gray's boss walks up to him.
So what the hell's this all about?
I thought a trip to Mount Vernon might do your soul some good.
Are you losing it? First, I order you to go to Little Rock
you refuse to go. You refuse to tell me why. Then you order me, your boss, I might add, to drop everything and meet you at George and Martha's place. I thought of dropping you into the ranks of the unemployed. I know damn well you'd slap me with a discrimination
suit.
She's
here.
Bird girl?
Is here.
You could have told me on the phone.
That wouldn't have been why.
And by the way, refusing to tell me where you could be reached did not exactly leave a good impression.
Well, I didn't want to take a chance. It's too risky to even go back to my apartment or to the job.
Well, where the hell have you been?
Stashed away in a little hotel.
This is one hell of a time to be punching notches.
No, we're not in
belt.
The same hotel. I'm renting cars. She's moving us around. She's helping me search for Garcia.
Sounds like she's the one with all the controls.
It's the only way she'd play.
So what if you can't find Garcia?
All right. Then we go to Plan B.
What's Plan B?
We attack the lawyers directly.
Yeah, what if it's another firm, not even in D.C.?
We go to Plan C.
What's that?
I don't know. We haven't gotten that far yet.
What if you do? Look, I've got to be able to get in touch with you.
Later, his boss is driving.
You need to get a hold of me. I'm at the Marbury Hotel, room 833. Don't use my name. Write it down.
Gray takes out a pen and paper.
You mind getting off at the next exit?
Why?
There's a tan car, two cars behind us. There's been two cars behind us since we got on the parkway.
He hands him a piece of paper. They get off at the exit, and the tan car continues past them down the parkway. Gray's boss looks at him.
I thought it was following us.
Right.
Gray opens his hotel room door. Inside, he sees a man run out the back door and jump over the balcony onto the roof of another building. Gray runs after him. He stops and watches the man jump over the side of the building. Shortly after, he runs out the front door of the hotel and gets into a cab. Rupert watches him and runs to another cab.
Georgetown Law School, please.
Gray looks out the rear window and sees the other cab following them.
Can you step on it?
The cab speeds up, and the other stays with them. They pass the Capitol. Near the White House, traffic is blocked by a demonstration, and Gray gets out of the cab. He runs past police and into the crowd of demonstrators. Rupert gets out of his cab and looks into the crowd, but can't see Gray. Some of the signs the demonstrators are holding read, "Politicians prefer unarmed subjects. Don't dial 911, dial 357. Liberals should be shot. And don't muzzle our rights." Is rushing through the crowd holding a sign in the shape of a pistol. Later, he's in a library. As he walks by, he taps on a table where Darby is sitting.
Meet me by the stacks.
She closes a book that has the address and phone number for White and Blazevich. She gets up and gathers her things. Shortly after, they're in a library room.
Someone was in my room.
Tell anyone where you were staying.
Smith came, but he never repeated.
You didn't tell him on the phone, did you?
Oh, no. We were in his... We were in his car.
Later.
Georgetown Law Center.
Placement office, please.
One moment, please. Placement office.
Hi, this is Susan Johnson. I'm a partner with White and Blazevich here in town. We're having some trouble with our computers. We're trying to reconstruct some payroll records, and the accountants have asked me to ask you for the names of your students that clerked here last summer.
Excuse me, I'm from White and Blazevich. You have something for me?
Yep.
Gray takes an envelope and starts to leave.
Thank you.
Oh, would you sign for this, please?
He comes back and signs.
Thank you, Mr. Stevens.
Later, they look at the list.
So I'll call these five and see who's at home.
I'll take the two with no phone numbers and get the class schedules from the register.
Darby nods, and Gray goes to the door of the library room, then looks back at her.
I'll see you later.
He leaves. Later, he's at the law school.
I'm Greg Grantham from the Washington Herald. I'm trying to find two students, Robert Akers and Laura Katz.
Is there a problem?
No problem, just a few questions I want to ask. Are they in class this morning?
One moment, please.
She walks away. Gray turns and sees Darby walk into a nearby room.
Excuse me. Do you have an ID?
He shows it. Darby is on a payphone.
Hello, yes. Could I speak to Dennis Mailer, please?
No, I'm Keith Mailer.
Oh, I'm sorry to bother you.
Yeah.
She writes the word home next to Keith Mailer's name. Gray is looking at the student schedules.
Akers has criminal procedure, Koss has administrative law, both from 9 to 10.
I'll try to find them. Mailer, Reinhardt, and Wilson were all at home.
I could be at Mailer's in a few minutes.
Later, Darby walks up to a student.
Excuse me. Would you happen to know Laura Cass?
Yes, she's just leaving. It's that girl with the red backpack.
Thank you.
Darby shows Laura a photo.
Do you recognize this man? He's a lawyer at White and Blazevich.
Later, Gray checks the list of students.
We're down to Akers and Lenny.
Lenny's phone was disconnected.
I'll get his class schedule.
I'll keep looking for Akers.
Afterwards.
Hello, it's me again. I need one more class schedule for Edward Lenny.
I'm sorry, Mr. Grantham. One of the students you talked to this morning called White and Blazevich, and they called the assistant dean. No more class schedules for reporters.
She walks away, and Gray leaves. A student who overheard the conversation follows him.
Mr. Grantham. I know Edward. He sort of dropped out of school for a while. Personal problems.
Where is he?
His parents put him in a private hospital. He's being detoxified. Look, he's a good guy. Park Lane Hospital.
Gray puts a hand on his shoulder, then walks away. Later, he pulls up to the hospital. He walks into the receptionist's office.
I'm here to see Edward Lenny. What room is he in?
And what is your name?
I'm Gray Grantham with the Washington Herald. They told me at the law school I could ask him a couple of questions.
I'm sorry they told you that, Mr. Grantham. You see, we run this hospital, and they run their law school.
Darby watches from the entrance.
May I see your administrator?
I'll see if I can find him.
The receptionist gets up and leaves. Gray motions for Darby to come forward. She walks past the receptionist's office and up a set of stairs. Gray looks up at her as she reaches a balcony.
Mr. Grantham. Great architecture. Yes. I'm sorry, Mr. Grantham. Visitation is only allowed on Saturdays and Sundays, and then only family.
A door has Lenny's name on it.
When do you expect Mr. Lenny to be discharged?
Oh, I'm afraid that's absolutely confidential.
Darby enters Lenny's room.
Perhaps when his insurance expires?
Gray takes out a pad and pen.
Do you recognize that man?
Lenny looks at the photo of Garcia.
What's his name?
That's the whole point. I don't know.
What is his name? He works in the oil and gas section on the 9th floor.
Lenny closes his eyes.
Morgan.
Darby starts to smile.
Yep, Morgan. His first name's something like Charles, but that's not it.
I can't tell you how grateful I am.
You know, when you open the door, I thought I was hallucinating again.
I'm sorry.
Oh, no. I'll take a hallucination like that. Anytime.
She smiles.
Take care of yourself.
She walks out, and there's a security guard in the hallway.
A
Excuse me, miss. What are you doing here?
Visiting my brother.
Who's your brother?
Edward Lenny.
Lenny comes out.
This your sister?
Darby turns and looks at him.
Yeah. Leave her alone.
Mom will be up on the weekend.
Sis, you come back soon.
I'll try.
Gray is with the administrator.
I hate to sound preachy, but I know you'd agree with me about the horrendous cost of health care.
Of course, of course. And I hope you understand now that we pride ourselves on our enlightened policy regarding payment.
Thank you very much for your time.
He sees Darby walk out and shakes the administrator's hand.
And we'll be happy to have you back on any of our normal visiting days.
Gray walks out. Afterward, Darby is driving while Gray looks through a book.
Morgan. Curtis Morgan. Oil and gas.
She smiles at him. Later, Darby is dressed in a suit. She gets off an elevator and walks to a security desk.
White and Blazevich, please.
Second floor. Use the escalator.
The guard points and she walks to the escalator. The lobby is the same one that the man with the gold watch could see from his office. At the top of the escalator, Darby walks to a receptionist.
Hi, may I help you?
Dorothy Blythe, I have a 5 o'clock appointment with Curtis Morgan.
Could you have a seat for a moment?
I'll be right with you.
The receptionist walks away. Darby stands at the front desk for a moment, then sits in a chair at the glass wall that looks down on the building's atrium. Through the glass, she can see the receptionist approach a group of men at a conference table on the other side of the building. One of them stands and picks up a phone. A man is standing next to Darby.
Miss Blythe, you say you have an appointment with Curtis Morgan?
Yes, at 5.
When did you make the appointment?
2 weeks ago.
May I ask the nature of the appointment?
Quite obviously, I'm looking for an oil and gas lawyer.
Curtis Morgan is dead.
Why didn't someone call me?
We have no record of an appointment with Dorothy Blythe.
What happened to him?
He was mugged a week ago. Shot by street punks, we believe.
Do you have some identification?
He's security.
Security for what?
Please come with us, Miss Blythe. There's someone else you should talk to.
After the way I've been treated, I have no interest in talking to or dealing with anyone from this firm.
She walks out and rushes through the atrium lobby. In the parking garage, she bumps into Sneller and the man with the gold watch as she passes them. They start to go after her and she gets in the car with Gray.
They killed him.
They speed out of the garage.
I can't breathe.
Gray pulls into an alley, and they get out of the car. Darby walks unsteadily and struggles to pull off her jacket.
All right, just let it go.
Gray walks to her and takes her jacket. She hits his chest, and he holds her.
It's all right.
Later, they're in a hotel room, and Darby is resting on the bed.
Yes.
He ran the story about a week ago. Another mugging. Didn't even make the front page of the Metro section. Curtis Morgan, 225 Willow Road, Bethesda.
225 Willow Road, Bethesda. That's what I wanted.
All right, make sure you report in before noon tomorrow. We're nervous over here. You know, Grantham, good help is hard to find.
Gray is sitting on the edge of the bed. Darby's back is to him.
I'm going with you.
Look at me.
She turns and looks at him.
I want you to leave.
And if you need confirmation for your story,
I'm on my own.
What's changed your mind?
I want you to reach 25.
I'm going with you.
Near the U.S. flags on the National Mall, the balding man walks up to Sneller, another man, and a woman. Sneller introduces him to the woman and the man. Later, a man opens a door.
Good evening.
Yes.
I'm Greg Grantham with the Washington Herald. This is my assistant. Would you like to speak with Mrs. Morgan?
I'm her father. She doesn't want to talk.
Well, I respect her privacy, sir. I know she's been through quite an ordeal.
When did you people ever respect anyone's privacy?
I feel the same way about most reporters myself, sir, but you see, her husband called me 3 times before he died. And I don't believe his death was an accidental murder.
She doesn't want to talk. Now get the hell out of here.
He shuts the door.
Change your mind, sir. You can be reached at this number.
He writes on a card and slips it through the mail slot. As he and Darby walk to their car, Sneller and the balding man are watching from a parked car. Darby and Gray pull away, and the men follow. Later, Darby is lying awake in bed. In the next room, Gray is also in bed and awake.
Yes?
Mr. Grantham?
Yes.
This is Mrs. Morgan.
He leans up on his elbow.
Mr. Grantham, do you still want to see me?
Later, he's sitting with her in a screened-in porch.
Did you know that your husband called me?
No. How would he know anything about those dead judges?
Mrs. Morgan, I have no idea. Did he keep any unusual documents or papers?
We have a lockbox at the bank for deeds and wills and stuff. We looked at it last Thursday with my father. There was nothing unusual in it. When Saturday morning, I was going through his desk in the bedroom, I found something a bit unusual. A key.
Key to what?
Another lockbox.
Which bank?
Riggs Bank. We've never banked there.
And you didn't know anything about this other box?
Until Saturday morning. I figured I'd run by when I felt up to it.
Maybe you should check it, Mrs. Morgan. Could be a clue to who killed your husband.
You're saying that you think that Curtis was deliberately killed because he knew something about these assassinations?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
The balding man is listening on an earpiece.
And you think that there may be papers in the safe deposit box that may reveal what Curtis knew about the assassinations?
There could be.
My child's lost one parent. I can't let her lose another.
Her eyes are filled with tears.
I'll check it for you. No one has to know you have the key.
I think they wouldn't give it to anybody but his wife.
My partner's a woman. She's very trustworthy.
I would have one condition. If you find something that disparages my husband in any way, you can't use it.
You have my word, Mrs. Morgan.
The next day, Gray and Darby walk out of a parking garage while Sneller and the balding man watch. Sneller gets out of the car and the balding man pulls into the garage. He drives through it slowly while looking at the parked cars. Suddenly, he stops and backs up. He grins and backs up farther. Darby walks into the bank.
Could you tell me where the safe deposit boxes are?
Right down those steps.
Thank you.
She heads down the stairs. The woman and the man that Sneller introduced on the mall walk into the bank. In the parking garage, the balding man carries a briefcase to Gray's car and opens the door with a Slim Jim. He sits in the car, opens the briefcase, and takes out a metal box with wires coming out of it. He places the box deep under the driver's side dash and connects the wires. He pulls out a metal rod and a small red light comes on. He closes the briefcase. Darby approaches a woman.
I need access to a box, please.
The number, please.
616.
She sits in a chair in front of the woman's desk.
This box was rented 2 weeks ago.
Yes.
I assume you're Mrs. Morgan?
Sarah Ann Morgan.
The address?
225 Willow Road, Bethesda.
Phone number?
301-555-7128.
Who rented this box?
My husband, Curtis D. Morgan.
And his social security number.
She looks in her purse.
510-968686.
We sign here, please. May I help you?
I'd like to rent a safe deposit box.
Oh, will you have a seat, please? I'll be with you in a minute.
Thank you.
Do you have your keys?
Yes, I do.
Follow me.
She follows her. When they leave, the woman from the mall takes Darby's empty seat. Darby walks into the vault. The woman from the bank turns a key in the box and Darby turns a second key. The woman opens the box and walks away. Darby looks inside and takes out a videotape and a manila envelope. She takes a quick look at the papers in the envelope, then closes it and puts it in her purse with the videotape. She walks out of the vault. The woman from the mall follows her. Darby walks up the stairs and out of the bank. Gray meets her on the steps outside, and they walk down the street. The couple from the mall are following them. Darby and Gray walk to the car in the garage and get in. The balding man is watching. Darby takes the papers out of the envelope.
A four-page affidavit signed under oath before notary public.
Look, it's dated the day before the last time he called me.
You worked at White and Blazevich in the oil and gas section for 5 years.
Gray starts to put the key in the ignition.
Oh, listen to this. During that time, he worked for a client who was engaged in a huge lawsuit in South Louisiana. The client was a man named Victor Matisse, who he's never met. Thoughts about the lawsuit, how much it meant to Matisse, how desperate he was to win it.
Just as if you wrote it.
He puts the key in the ignition.
A partner named Sims Wakefield supervised the case for WNB, and Morgan worked on the periphery of the case. He took a bunch of files and documents that Wakefield left on his desk for him, not related to the case. When he got back to his own office, he found a handwritten memo on the bottom of the stack of documents. He had inadvertently taken it from Wakefield's desk. A copy of a memo is attached to the affidavit. He made a copy of the memo, placed the original in the same position under the files on his desk.
Stop, Washington Herald.
She looks up.
No, stop. Greg, get out of the car.
They get out and run as the balding man watches. Gray tries to open a stairwell door, but it's locked. They start to run through the garage. The man from the mall shoots at them, and they run the other way. The woman from the mall shoots and hits a windshield. Gray and Darby climb over a railing. They jump to a lower level of the garage and land on the hood of a car, then keep running. With her gun drawn, the woman from the mall looks around for them, but the garage is still and silent. She walks slowly and quietly past the parked cars. Gray and Darby are crouched down and leaning against a cement wall. As the woman with the gun approaches a railing, she looks down and can see Gray and Darby reflected in the chrome of the side view mirror of a car. She takes aim at them, just as a Doberman snaps at her through a car window. Gray and Darby run to another stairwell door. This one opens and they run up the stairs. Above them, the man is coming down the stairs with a gun. They run out of the stairwell just as he shoots. They're in the parking garage, and the balding man drives toward them at full speed. They run around a corner, and the balding man tries to follow. car fishtails and smashes into Gray's car. Both cars explode.
There was a car explosion in a garage near the Riggs Bank. The police traced the car to a leasing agency. It was rented yesterday by Gray Grantham.
A man is in Smith's office.
Have you heard from Grantham?
Not since yesterday. I should never have kept him on that story.
What story?
See what else you can find.
Smith picks up the phone and the other man leaves. Smith dials, then sees Gray and Darby walking toward his office. They enter.
Smith Keene, meet Darby Shaw. So, Mr. Grantham, what the hell's going on?
The video and envelope drop on a desk. Curtis Morgan appears on a monitor.
Sweetheart, I'm down here in the basement. It's late. It's about 10 in the morning. This is an affidavit that, concerning a memo that I found on my desk. I'm going to trust you to do with it what you will. The memo's from M. Valmano. He's a senior partner. It was dated September 28th, addressed to Wakefield, and it read, Sims, advise client, research is complete. And the bench will sit much softer if the old man is retired. The second retirement is a bit unusual, Jensen of all people. Advise further that the Pelican should arrive here in 4 years, assuming other factors. There's no signature. Then Justices Rosenberg and Jensen were killed. There's no doubt in my mind this is the work of Matisse and his associates. The memo doesn't mention Matisse, but it refers to a client. Wakefield had no other clients. No one client had as much to gain from the new court as Matisse. I thought that I was protecting us by not revealing what I found. But you'll only see this if I'm gone, so I will have failed. I'm sorry, sweetheart.
Gray, Darby, Smith, and others from the newspaper are watching the tape.
I'll always be with you. Always.
The man with the gold watch is on the phone.
Mr. Grantham, this is Mario Valmano. What a pleasure. What can I do for you?
We're running a story in the morning about your client, Victor Matisse, and his involvement in the assassinations of Justices Rosenberg and Jensen.
Great! We'll sue your ass for the next 20 years. You'll be named as a defendant. Oh, this will be great. Victor Matisse alone, the Washington Herald. This is fabulous.
I don't know if you've heard of the Pelican Brief. We have a copy of it. We also have a copy of a memo sent by you to Sims Wakefield, dated April 11th, in which you suggest your client's position would be greatly improved by the removal of Justices Rosenberg and Jensen from the court.
Yeah. I noticed you waited till 5 o'clock. An hour earlier, we could have run to court to stop this damn thing.
Do you deny you wrote the memo?
It's a fabrication.
You have no lawsuit, Mr. Valmano. And you know it.
You son of a bitch.
Darby is listening on another extension.
Mr. Cole, are you familiar with the Pelican Brief?
I am.
We're running a story which, in summary, verifies the facts set forth in that brief. And we have confirmed that Mr. Matisse contributed in excess of $4 million to the president's campaign 3 years ago.
$4,200,000, all through legal channels.
That's right. We also believe that the White House intervened and tried to obstruct the FBI investigation into Mr. Matisse, and we were wondering if there were any comments.
The White House emphatically denies any direct or indirect involvement in any aspect of this investigation. You received some bad information, Gray.
A picture of Cole's family is on his desk.
Mr. Boyles, Mr. Grantham, Washington Herald.
Yes?
We're running a story in the morning detailing a conspiracy in the assassinations of Rosenberg and Jensen. We're naming Victor Matisse, an oil speculator, and two of his lawyers from here in town. We believe the FBI knew about Matisse early on, but refused to investigate at the urging of the White House, and we wanted to give you guys a chance to comment.
Voiles and another man from the FBI get off an elevator at the newspaper. Gray and Darby watch as they walk into Smith's office. Cole unlocks a door and walks into the surveillance room with the monitor of the Oval Office. He watches the screen as the president walks into the office with his dog. Cole furrows his brow and sighs deeply as he watches.
Roll over.
Roll over. A man walks into the Oval Office.
You know, I think we're going to have a great success with these people. They were really very pleased and genuinely cooperative. What's that?
He whispers to the president. The president slowly lowers himself into his chair. Darby and Gray enter an office where Smith, Voiles, and the other FBI man are waiting.
You know Gray Grantham? And this is Darby Shaw.
They sit.
So you're the little lady who started this great brouhaha.
I think you have me confused with a friend of the president.
I have some comments. For the record. First,
Gray turns on a tape recorder.
First, we received a copy of the Pelican brief 2 weeks ago and submitted it to the White House on the same day. It was not considered high priority in the investigation until Mr. Gavin Verheek, special counsel to the director, was found murdered in New Orleans.
Did the White House interfere with the FBI investigation of Matisse?
I'll discuss it off the record.
Gray stops the recorder.
Last Wednesday, the president asked me to ignore Victor Matisse as a suspect. In his words, he asked me to back off. I have a tape, which I will allow no one to hear unless the president first denies this.
So what do you do now?
There'll be a grand jury by noon tomorrow. Quick indictments. And we'll find Matisse. I'd like a few minutes alone with Ms. Shaw. That is, if she doesn't mind.
It's her call.
I'd like Mr. Grantham to stay.
Smith and the other FBI man leave.
What's next for you?
Who killed the man who masqueraded as Gavin Verheek?
Oh, you mean the assassin, Kamel. Off the record, the man who killed Kamel was a contract operative hired independently by the CIA.
Rupert?
He probably has 20 names.
Why was he following her?
I think the brief initially scared Kaminsky more than the rest of us. He probably sent Rupert to trail Darby.
In part to watch and in part to protect. We can help. What do you want?
I want to leave the country alone.
All right. We'll get you out of this building. We'll put you in my plane. We'll fly you anywhere you want, and you can disappear from there. But you must allow me to contact you, Sir Mr. Grantham here, if and only if it becomes urgently necessary.
Darby looks at Gray.
That's fine. I want no one on the plane but me, Gray, and the pilots. After takeoff, I'll instruct the pilot where we're going.
Well, he has to file a flight plan before he can leave.
You're the director of the FBI. Set it up.
Later, they're in an airplane hangar. Darby and Gray get on the small jet. Men get into two cars parked nearby and drive away. The plane flies through a cloudy night sky. Inside, Darby is asleep on Gray's shoulder. Her hand is resting on his arm. Gray looks at her and smiles slightly, then rests his head against the seat. The plane lands and pulls into a hangar. The stairs of the plane are lowered. A van with a rotating yellow light on top pulls beside the plane. Darby and Gray descend the stairs. A man from the van hands them an envelope. Gray opens it, and inside is a copy of the front page of the Washington Herald. The headline reads, "Assassination Plot Exposed." The byline reads, "By Gray Grantham and Darby Shaw." He points to the byline and they both smile. Gray looks at the man waiting in the van, then turns to Darby. She shakes his hand and kisses his cheek, then walks toward the van. She turns and looks at him. He watches as she walks back to him. She hugs him and he holds her tightly. They let go and she smooths the front of his jacket. She looks at him, then walks away again. He watches as she gets in the van. She waves as they pull away. He waves back, and she smiles as her eyes fill with tears. Gray stands alone next to the airplane for a moment, then boards. The yellow light on the van flashes as it drives through the airport.
Our guest today is Gray Grantham,
who, as just about everybody in America must know by now, revealed the plot behind the assassinations of Justices Rosenberg and Jensen. Gray, the ripple effects of your story just don't seem to stop. As of this broadcast, Victor Matisse, one of the richest men in the country, has been indicted, along with four of his aides and lawyers. Fletcher Cole, President's Chief of Staff, has resigned. And we're getting strong indications that the President himself will not even run again. Well, that's what we do know. Let's get to what we don't. We know that the Pelican Brief was written by a woman named Darby Shaw, but we don't know who that is. Who is Darby Shaw?
Darby is watching TV near a beach.
I think that's a question for Darby Shaw.
All right, that leads me to my second question. Speaking for thousands of our colleagues who are in a feeding frenzy to interview her, where is Darby Shaw?
I think that also is a question for Darby Shaw, but I know that she's not available to answer questions as long as this feeding frenzy continues.
Now, does that mean you don't know where she is?
Darby smiles.
I didn't say that.
Then you do know. I take it this cryptic smile means you're not answering.
Gray takes a sip of water.
Okay, Gray, you know, in view of all of this, you know that there's a lot of speculation that this woman is a figment of your imagination, that you created her from a lot of different sources. Just as there are people who believe there was no Deep Throat, there are those who believe there is no Darby Shaw. In other words, she's just too good to be true.
She almost is.
Darby's smile widens. Narrative script written by Beth Sharp for the Emmy.